So I'm Phil Libin. I'm the CEO of Evernote, and I wanted to talk today a little bit about the 100-year startup, about trying to build a 100-year company, because that's what we're trying to do at Evernote. And I guess the short question is, how do you build a 100-year company? And the short answer is I don't really know. We've never done it yet. But we have some ideas, and I'll talk about kind of how we're thinking about it and how we're approaching it and how we're hoping that that it'll actually work out and why we think it's important to do it. I'd like this talk to be really interactive because I guess it is an interactive show, so feel free to interrupt me at any time and ask questions. There's kind of two ways to do that. There's a microphone up here, so you can come up at any time, and I'll see you standing there take a question, or just raise your hands, and then what'll happen is if you shout a question from the audience, I'll just repeat it so that the microphones pick it up, and also I'll rephrase it to be more pithy and entertaining and interesting for people in the podcast. So either way is fine with me. I guess before we talk about a 100-year company, I wanted to just spend a couple of minutes talking about Evernote. I realize that some people here probably know what Evernote is, but I'm sure not everyone does. And so I just wanted to go over what we are very briefly. So basically, the goal of Evernote is to be your external brain. We figured that no one was fully satisfied with their meat brain. Everyone wants to be smarter. Everyone wants to have a better memory. Everyone wants to be more productive. So we wanted to create a service that basically is your external brain. It's a service that lets you remember everything, all of your important business, personal, educational, family memories, and make them accessible and make them easy to use for you at any time. I'll give one example of a use case that I use it for. In fact, this is actually the very first use case. This is the first complete Evernote use case that I personally experienced soon after we launched in 2008. This is the use case that we raised all of our first rounds of funding on. And it was the first time that I actually knew when this was complete, I actually knew that, yeah, we had something there. Like, this felt like a complete product. So basically, in 2008, I was online, I was on Slate, and I saw this article about buying eyeglasses online. And it basically said, hey, you can buy prescription eyewear online, and it's actually a pretty good experience. And until then, I never thought of that. I've been wearing eyeglasses my whole life, obviously, because I'm a giant nerd. But I never thought that you could buy them online. So I saw that and I'm like, oh, cool. And so I clipped it. I used the Evernote web clipper to clip it to Evernote. So now I had it in my account. And then I needed this from my PC at work. And then a few months later, my eyeglasses broke. And I was like, oh, sweet, I'm prepared for this. I know what to do. So I was at home. I was in a different computer. I got up my Mac. I pulled this up out of Evernote. It actually disappeared from Slate at the time, so you can't find this article on Slate anymore. It's gone. But since I clipped it, I still had it. So I found the article, and I read through it, and I clicked on some of the links that it suggested. And so I went to this website, and I clipped the glasses that I was interested in. So I clipped these, and I came home, and I showed them to my wife. And I said, hey, what do you think about these glasses? And she said, over my dead body. Said, all right, well, how about these? These are a little cooler. And she said, yeah, okay, those could be okay. So I clicked through to this note, to the URL in the note, to go to the actual e-commerce site, bought the glasses, and then when I was checking out, of course, they ask you for your prescription so they can make the lenses. Well, a few months earlier, when I had gotten my eyes examined at the mall, eye doctor, because, only the best healthcare for me, when I was done, they handed me my prescription. My eyesight prescription. I just took a picture of it. I snapped a picture of it with my iPhone, and I had it in Evernote. And when I needed my prescription, I just searched. Since you can search for words and any images in Evernote, I just searched for my name and eyeglasses, and I found this prescription slip. It may be a little bit dark on the projector, but you can see it's sort of a handwritten prescription. So I typed that in, and I got the glasses. Successful use case. The glasses showed up. I took them home. I showed them to my wife. She said, no, those aren't going to work at all. I have to get glasses for you. So she kind of dragged me outside to the store, completely defeating the whole point of this exercise of me getting them online, picked out these glasses and said, here, you're getting these glasses right here. I said, fine. I went to pay for them. The clerk at the store, of course, needed my prescription, so I just did the exact same query on my iPhone, handed my iPhone over. They filled in my prescription, got me my glasses. So that was kind of an end-to-end use case, right? It combined things that I did in a few different computers, a PC at work, a Mac at home, some notes that I took, some web clips, some mobile usage, all in support of some research, two e-commerce transactions, one real-world brick-and-mortars commerce transaction, and general domestic marital harmony. That was the first ever use case. And when I did this, I thought, okay, yeah, this is actually getting somewhere. This is kind of like my external brain. So this is what I was doing in Evernote in 2008, and here's what I did during one day last week. So these are all use cases that I did within about a 12-hour period of each other in one day. I was at a conference. So I used Evernote Hello, one of our new apps, to remember people that I was meeting at the conference and storing that in Evernote. I also used Evernote Food to remember the really awesome scotch that some of these people, the high-quality ones, are recommending for me at this conference a week ago. I was doing research for a board meeting that I've got coming up next week, so I was clipping a lot of things from different sources so I can prepare my board material. So in particular, I was looking for coverage of mobile OSs by territory. I'm in the process of buying a house, so I'm actually going back and forth with a contractor, so they sent me these giant floor plans, because I guess they still don't have electronic floor plans. So they sent me these big floor plans, so I laid them all out, and I used my iPad to take a picture of them with Sketch, and then I could just Sketch right on top of the floor plan. So I just say, hey, can we put a sliding door right here? Immediately communicate exactly what we want, send it over to the contractor. I used it to record an audio note. I was doing a presentation. I was supposed to introduce this guy with a name that I was sure I wouldn't pronounce right, so I had him record saying his name and then practiced it over and over and over again in Evernote until I had overthought it so much that I completely got it wrong when I actually introduced him. But that's not the fault of the product. That's the fault of the... That is, the user is a doofus error. I worked back and forth with our designer on the upcoming logo for our Chinese launch, and I got Reid Hoffman to autograph, again, in Sketch, the title page of his ebook. So I bought this in iBooks, had him autograph it in Sketch, and now I have in my Evernote account, a notebook of autographs from cool books. This is actually a great book, and I know Reid just gave a fantastic talk here a couple of days ago. So that's the Evernote use case. It's really meant to be everything that you want in your brain at all times. Some quick at-a-glance slides of stats of how we're doing now compared to how we ended the year. So we have about 25 million users. In fact, I think we just crossed that number a few days ago. That's up from about 6 million at the end of last year. About 9 million 30-day active users. We're adding about 60,000 users a day, every day, which is really pretty cool. It's a very large football stadium every day. Not that I've ever been to a large football stadium, but I'm told that they hold about 50,000 to 60,000 people. We have about almost a million paying users, Evernote Premium users, and we have about 141 employees. That's about a tripling in headcount. We're all over the world. In particular, we're really big in Japan. Actually, 21% of our users are in Japan, which is just cool because they love going to Japan and eating Japanese food and seeing all the cool gadgets and partners that we have over there. And we're getting really big there. So we're growing quickly everywhere in the world, but Japan is probably still my favorite place to go. In fact, I am getting on a plane right after this talk and headed to Tokyo, which I really enjoy. Japan is kind of a country of enthusiasts. It's sort of a country of nerds. Everyone in Japan is sort of a nerd about something. They all know more than they should about some particular topic. And Evernote has become really compatible with that. Like that enthusiasm is just really compatible with Evernote. It's really a information collector's culture. And just in the past year, we've opened offices everywhere. This is kind of the most terrifying part for me as a manager. We're in our headquarters in California, in Silicon Valley. We have a great office here in Austin, Texas, and we're hiring for very aggressively. That's actually where we're building Sketch. And offices in Zurich, Moscow, Beijing, Tokyo, and Singapore. And these are our products. So the central product is Evernote. Evernote is what you have an account with. That's what you trust. That is your second brain. And then we have a series of really beautiful, specific experiences around particular types of memories that are individual mobile apps. So Evernote Food for remembering food, Evernote Hello for remembering people you meet, and so on. And the point is, all of these are really meant to work together to enhance your experience. This has been a really great year for us. In fact, we've gotten some great recognition. We were named the Inc. Company, Inc. Magazine Company of the Year, which was a really unexpected honor. In fact, we knew they were working on a story, about us, obviously, but we didn't know that it was going to be the cover story. We didn't know that it was going to be Company of the Year until I saw these magazines at an airport when I was walking through, and that was a kind of a cool and shocking experience seeing a picture of myself and some of the other team staring out from the stands, and lots of really great community awards that we're very happy with. So it's a little bit about Evernote, and our goal was always to build this 100-year company, this 100-year startup. And the reason we wanted to do it was Evernote is my third company. And in fact, many of the founding team were either with me at my previous two companies or with our other founder, Stepan Pachikov, at his previous companies. Evernote's not the first startup for really hardly any of us. And my previous two companies were interesting technology companies that did cool things, and we sold both companies. But we never felt like we were building them for us. The first company, okay, hang on a second, it's really hot. Now I have to figure out where to pin this to. Yeah, this is going to go very poorly. Yeah? Ooh, good idea. It's excellent entertainment for you folks. Can you guys actually hear me like this?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That went far less disastrous than I was envisioning in my head. So my first company was an e-commerce company. We made software for big retailers, and we sold the company to Vignette in Austin. That's actually how I fell in love with Austin for the first time, and that was cool. It was a good experience, but we weren't a retailer, so we weren't building the product for us, and we sold the company, so we didn't even get to keep it. And our second company was a security company, doing large software for the government and for banks, but we weren't a large bank or a government, and we weren't really building for us. And we sold the company, so we didn't get to keep it. And we said, the third time around, we really want to build something different. We really want to build products that we want. We want to build products for us. And we don't want there to be an exit. We want Evernote to be our life's work. And we don't want an exit strategy. We want to build a company for us that we get to keep forever. Frankly, just because that seems more cool. That seems a more interesting thing to do than to try to spend, to try to make something that you're just going to wind up getting rid of. We figured, well, it takes so much work to make a company. It takes so much energy. It takes so much out of you that if you're not building for 100 years, you're kind of selling yourself short. It's going to take just as much effort to make something that you're going to try to sell in 3 years as something that you get to keep. And at the end of the day, we thought, well, we're done with building for other people. We want to build for us, so we want to build the 100-year startup. And in particular, this 100-year idea really crystallized when we started going to Japan, and we started meeting with some of our Japanese partners, and there are many companies in Japan that are more than 100 years old that are still innovating. In fact, there's this one company, one of our partners called Yuchida Yoko, that's started out as kind of a furniture and office supply company. I think they're 102 years ago, continue to operate and continue to innovate. And when you walk into their office, they have this beautiful museum in their gallery, in their lobby. It's kind of a semicircular display, and the first half shows 100 years, with sort of each year running down vertically with examples of their products in this really beautiful way, and you can see the evolution of the products over the 100 years, and it ends in the middle, and the next half is totally empty. It's totally blank for the next 100 years. And that idea that you can have a company that's 100 years old that's actually still innovating was very much the inspiration. So we decided to try to do this ourselves, not just to build a company that would last for 100 years, but to build a company that would be the 100-year startup, which I guess is important to distinguish. So what is a startup? Well, what is entrepreneurship? I searched around a lot for a good definition of this, and the best definition that I found on entrepreneurship is this by Howard Stevenson, who's a professor at Harvard Business School. And I think this is really interesting. It says, entrepreneurship is the pursuit of opportunity without regard to resources currently controlled. And I think this is the crucial thing that separates startups, that separates entrepreneurs from more matured, more entrenched existing companies, right? You have an idea, you have some opportunity that you want to pursue, but you don't really, you don't limit yourself by how unrealistic it is. You don't limit yourself by what resources you currently have. The only resources you have in the beginning is an idea and some passion, and that's enough. So this is the inspiration. We want to spend 100 years not being constrained by our resources, being constrained only by what we actually want to achieve and to pursue opportunity at every place. So what's the recipe for this? Well, I think there's not a specific recipe. There's a technique. There's an algorithm. There's not a specific series of steps. In fact, to extend the food metaphor more, I think building a 100-year startup, it's not really like baking. It's not like you have precise measurements under precise timescale, and you measure everything, and you combine all the ingredients, and then you put them in the oven, and you set it for 100 years, and then you get this pie. It's not like that at all. It's more like it's more like cooking, right? It's much more spontaneous. It's much more you make thousands of course corrections. You mix things. You see how things taste. You see where you are. You try to keep things in balance so that you're constantly creating something that is that satisfies the goal of being a 100-year company. So it's really about figuring out what are the things you need to keep in balance and how to keep them in balance. So what can go out of balance in 100 years? Quite a lot, I guess. I guess there's sort of four main things. There's four main things that, if you keep in balance, what we're trying to do is keep these things in balance and make them work for us to build a great and valuable company. And the four things are basically, well, there's you, there's your team, your investors, and your customers. And those are kind of the four things that I want to talk about with some stats, and we'll get into a combination. The rest of this talk will be a combination of very kind of high-level cloudy, head-in-the-sky sentiments, and some pretty hardcore data to back some of this up. So the first thing is you. There's a big danger here, right, of basically you screwing this up, you getting bored. 100 years is a long time. Even if you don't plan on being involved in the company for all of those years, there's still a big danger of you just sort of not liking what you're doing, right? Getting bored, wanting to do something else, losing your interest, losing your enthusiasm. And if you do that as the founder, that's pretty much it. That's pretty much the end. This was actually one of my main reasons for getting out of my last company, which was a government security company. I just got really bored. I realized that I didn't want to become a lifelong person that was an expert in Department of Defense procurement schedules, and I was becoming that, right? I was becoming someone who understood a lot about how the Pentagon buys systems, and frankly, that was boring. And at some point, I decided I would rather chew my own arm off than have to sit through one more, budget planning cycle for our, DHS or something like that. So there's a big danger that you're just going to get bored in whatever you start. So how do you prevent against it? Well, I guess in the easiest way is you just build what you love, right? This was the strategy for Evernote. So Evernote is built for us. It's the product that we want to use and the company that we want to have. In particular, it's built for me, and it's meant to be my external brain. And so when I think about my external brain, it kind of looks like this. This is this picture is from a stipple print from the cover of the Wall Street Journal. So when I was a kid, one of my goals as a kid was to get one of those, dot portraits on the cover of the Wall Street Journal. I was a very weird kid. This was actually one of my fantasies. And I had a strategy for this. So a couple of years ago, the Wall Street Journal was writing a story about me, and I'm like, oh, this is my opportunity. Now I spring into action. And I did by begging them repeatedly to make me a stipple print to put me on the cover. And I did it by saying, come on, please make me a stipple print to put me on the cover. And they said, no, we can't do that. And I said, come on, please. I really, really like it. I've been wanting this since I was a little kid. And they said, no. Anyway, I kept begging. I wasn't proud. And it happened. I actually ran a cover story, so there was a stipple print of me and the cover of the Wall Street Journal, one major childhood dream fulfilled. And when I envisioned what this would be like, as a kid, when I used to dream about this, I used to think I'd be on the cover of the Wall Street Journal with a portrait for, curing cancer or, inventing something great. And actually, it was an article about people who carry too many gadgets in their backpack. But whatever, good enough, right? Childhood dream fulfilled. As soon as I got this, I started using this everywhere. My brother said, "Oh, you should make that your Twitter avatar." I'm like, if I make this my Twitter avatar, then everyone's going to put their Wall Street Journal cover stipple prints as their Twitter avatar. But I did anyway, because I'm not proud. Anyway, so when I look at Evernote and I look at my brain, I realize that my brain exists in kind of two states. There's some of the time when what I really want to do is kill time, and sometimes I want to save time. So let's say I'm waiting for a friend, you know, at a coffee bar, and I've got 5 minutes because, you know, my friends are running late. What am I going to do? Well, 5 years ago, I wouldn't have done anything because you couldn't do anything in 5 minutes at a coffee shop 5 years ago. But now, there's tons of things I could do. I could take out my phone or my tablet. I could do something. So what do I want to do? Well, if I want a diversion, if I want that 5 minutes to go by quickly, if I want to have fun, if I want to check up what my friends are doing, I've got tons of features, tons of options. There's lots of really, really beautiful products, beautiful companies that have been created in the past 5 or so years to be a diversion, to kill time, to make me connect with friends. And that's not a criticism. That's not a knock by any means of these companies. They've really, really innovated. What these companies have done is they figure out how to make software that's super beautiful, that's highly engaging, that a billion people will themselves choose to use and spend a lot of time with, without being coerced to do it. Right? Very few IT departments force their employees to play Angry Birds, and yet, you know, a billion people still play them. So these companies really innovated on what it takes to make highly engaging, highly rich software, but it's for the purposes of being social or killing time. And when I want that, then that's my half. That's great. Actually, lately it's been Minecraft. I've been killing way too much time with Minecraft. But sometimes I don't want that. Sometimes I want to get something accomplished. I want to save time, and that's what Evernote is for me. So Evernote for me is meant to fill that part of my brain when I still want to spend the same 5 minutes, but I want to get something accomplished. We kind of want to be the Zynga of doing something useful. And we want to do it by learning from these other companies, right? We want the experience of using Evernote to be just as engaging, just as much fun, just as rewarding as having a diversion, as playing a video game, as connecting with your friends. But at the end, you've actually moved your life's work forward a little bit. You've actually accomplished something. And I actually think accomplishing something could be even more engaging and rewarding than not. So that's the goal, and we did it specifically because that's what we wanted, because this product didn't exist. Because when we looked at it, we said the idea of productivity software is sort of stuck 25 years in the past. The idea of productivity software is still stuck around Office as the concept. But that idea doesn't make any sense. The idea that productivity software is, you know, a database, whatever that even means anymore, and a spreadsheet and a word processor, that's 25 years in the past. That doesn't take into account any of the past two decades of developments of social networks and smartphones and app stores and tablets. We want it to be the new definition of what productivity software could be, making it just as entertaining as this diversionary software. And it didn't exist, and so that's what we set out to do. And it's been pretty successful. And it's been pretty successful largely because all we did was focus on making the product that we love. And I don't think we could have done that 5 years ago. In fact, I know that at my first company and my second company, that wouldn't have been good enough. But it is good enough now, which is why I think today is kind of a unique time. It's the first time in the history of the universe where maybe it's actually possible to build a 100-year company based solely on doing something that you love. And we're hardly unique on this. If you look at several of the really popular and valuable recent brands, many of them have this in common, right? They were built not as a business first. They were built to address a particular need, a particular itch that the founder or founders have, right? So Uber, I was talking to Travis last week, Uber, which has changed my life completely. Like, I love Uber. I barely remember. It's hard for me to remember what my life was like before Uber. It was only a few months ago, so I know it was there. And I had Evernote, so I have all my notes. But it's like I must have led some kind of barbaric, atavistic existence where I got into cabs and things like that. I can barely remember it. Uber wasn't created as a business, even though it's growing very quickly and they're extremely valuable. It was created literally because Travis and his group of friends wanted to look fancy and ride around in fancy cars in San Francisco. And so they just made kind of a private club for themselves without really any thought about making it a business until later. Similar thing with Instagram. Similar thing with Square, right? Square was made because Jack Dorsey's friend, I think a glass maker, couldn't sell some of his products, couldn't get an order. So it was made for very specific needs. Skitch, the company that we acquired last year that's done fantastically well, more than 6 million users in about 6 months just on Skitch, was made specifically so that Chris and Keith could have something they could very quickly and visually use to communicate changes that they wanted on websites and documents and pictures. So this is a fairly new phenomenon, right? This didn't used to happen very often 20 years ago. I mean, think about a company that was created 20 years ago that was a large, successful, valuable company that wasn't created as a business, that was created just because the founders wanted to do something cool and just actually made it for themselves, and then it became a business. Compare Uber with FedEx, right? Actually kind of comparable, both logistics businesses, both kind of very, very, you know, complex algorithms to make it work. But FedEx was this massive multi-year, you know, affair where the business plan, just writing the plan took years, doing the calculations, doing the modeling, figure out what kind of airplanes to get, figure out how much fuel to set up, figuring out where to set up the various warehouses and depots. Like, that was a major undertaking. Like, FedEx started as a hardcore plan. It wasn't somebody said, hey, I need a way to get a package delivered in a day. Let's buy some airplanes and make that happen. Uber, which logistically is almost as complicated, I mean, much more real-time, smaller scale, but real-time, didn't start with any of that. There wasn't any initial planning. It was just let's get this thing done, and that's possible today. And it wasn't possible 20 years ago and 10 years ago for some very specific reasons, for some very specific things that we'll get to. And so that first thing that you have to watch out for, right? You yourself getting bored. The good news is you can beat that now just by figuring out what you really love, and just building that. And if you love something and you build a product that you yourself love to use, chances are there's another billion people that love it too. Unless your tastes are really quite niche, which is possible. Chances are, if you build something that you love, there's another million, 10 million, 100 million, billion people that also love it. And because of the way the world is set up right now, they will all find out about it the next day. And so if you build a service like Uber that lets you ride around in fancy cars and you love it, so another billion people have loved as well. They will all know about it, that, you know, within a week of you launching, and you can have a great experience. So, the second thing to balance out is, your team. This is also obviously a big risk factor because you can't do anything by yourself. You have to have the team with you, and it kind of works like this. When you have 5 people in your company, your first 5 people, it's just 5 of you, you know, you and your co-founders, you know, sitting in a garage somewhere, when there's just 5 of you, all 5 of you are on a mission. Like, it's not a job, right? All 5 of you are on a mission. You're on a quest. You're on this mission from God to do this particular thing that you're doing. It is the most important thing in your life. It is an all-consuming passion to actually build this thing when there's 5 of you, and when there's 6 of you, and when there's 7 of you. But then when you have about 10 people, all of a sudden you realize that, like, hey, one of these guys, it's just a job for him. I'm not sure how he snuck in there, but, you know, the rest of us are like, this is the most important thing in our lives and we're killing ourselves for it, but for one of them, for that guy, for Chad, let's say, it's just a job. And God damn it, Chad. I mean, yeah, you know, you've got kids or whatever, and you want to spend time with them, but you know, everyone's got kids. You know, that's not interesting, but the work is interesting. I mean, come on, Chad. You know, every single ancestor that you have ever had has managed to also have kids, right? How unique is that? But only one of them, only you, has actually worked here. You know, get on it. And so when you have 10 people, you realize that one of them, you know, they could be really productive, but it's really just a job for them. And then when you have 100 people, you look around and you're like, wow, like half of these people, right, it's a job, if you're lucky. And if you're lucky, half of the people at 100 are on this mission, and half of them, it's, you know, it's a job. I mean, it could be their best job they've ever had. Hopefully it is. It's your job as a founder to make it the best job they ever had. But you have to make them productive. You can't force everyone to be on the same quest with you. You have to actually build this team. You have to build this company with a mixture of people who are the true believers who are in the same crusade, and people that it's a job. And when you're at 1,000 people, I don't know, you know, maybe 10% are kind of on this quest with you, and the rest of them are working. So this is the main obstacle to building a team. It's how do you balance out the people who are the true believers, right? The people who are in this, who are on a mission, who are with you every step of the way, who believe in what you believe in. And yet, to actually build something non-trivial, you also need to have a lot of people who are just working. And the first step of this is just to recognize that this is the way it's going to be. And I've actually seen a lot of startups, that I've mentored, that I've advised, startups that I've been involved with. Their first real test comes at this stage, right? When they're unable to process the idea that it is not a religion for everyone, only for some of you, and just recognizing that and then making these people productive is the core skill to kind of keeping things in balance for 100 years. So, the idea is you have to build a team that builds the product. When we think about the team at Evernote, it is completely inseparable from the product we build. You can't build the product with a different team. Instagram, I think I have 13 employees now or something like that, 25 million users. Instagram couldn't have been created by a different 13 people. Evernote could not have been created by a different team. The team that's building the product is fundamental. And so when we think about optimizing that team, we think about it in exactly the same way as we think about product features. So, for example, we have lunch brought in every day, just a standard thing. It makes a lot of sense just have everyone eat at the office instead of going out. We think about that lunch, what should be on the menu, how should it be served, what time should it be. We think about that in the same way as we think about adding, UI elements to the app. It's really the same kind of thing, right? We are building little pieces of infrastructure, in one case, to make sure that the team, is happy and well-fed and doesn't all feel like taking a nap for 40 minutes after lunch because we served, Italian food again. And the other one is making UI features, but they're really connected. And so we've really tried hard to align all of the incentives and to have a product approach to HR, to perks, to benefits, making sure that we're building the team out as much as we can. We've tried lots of different things in this. Some of the benefits that work really well for us, which you guys are free to steal for your own companies. The thing that works the best is, and this was kind of genius. I forget who actually recommended it in our staff. Oh, that's right, it was me. Is housekeeping, right? So every Evernote employee gets house cleaning. We get a house cleaning service. So if you work at Evernote, twice a month, every 2 weeks, you get maids that show up and clean your house. And this is great. It's not that cheap. It's a fairly expensive benefit, although it's much cheaper than health insurance and stuff like that. But it actually works really, really well because it this is something that everyone has to do. No one really enjoys it. It kind of frees you from not having to do it. And it completely aligns all of the nagging from the spouse in the direction of you better not be thinking about leaving that job. Which is intentional, right? And it's how we designed it. Like, that's how we engineered it. We say, well, people get nagged. Sometimes the nagging husband or the nagging wife is sort of saying, well, are you sure you're the right place? Maybe you should go here. Maybe you should look for other opportunities. You put in free housekeeping. It really aligns that incentives really, really, really well. So it's super popular with the spouses. And basically keeping the spouses happy is probably the easiest way to keep the employees happy and motivated. And at first, when we implemented this, we thought that that this would appeal more to the older employees that were married, that had houses, that had kids. But actually, the young guys really love it just as much. In fact, we have employees that advertise, like when they look for roommates, they advertise that, like, I come with house cleaning. Like, if you get me as a roommate, you also get a house cleaning service. So it works great. There's a little bit of things like some people aren't completely comfortable with the class distinctions. Like, some people aren't completely comfortable of having housekeepers, a serving class. They're just kind of, a little bit sensitive about the class issues. And we're okay, we understand that. So actually what we're about to do is we're about to institute a program where we can also hand out top hats and monocles that you can wear while your house cleaners are cleaning. just if you need that to make it clearer as to what's actually going on there. We wanted to do tech support. We realized that Evernote employees, for the most part, are nerds of some kind. And they're exactly the kind of people that get roped into doing endless IT tech support for their families and their extended families. And so we thought, okay, well, maybe if you work at Evernote, your family gets tech support, so they can leave you alone. We're still trying to figure out how to implement that. That's a bit tough. But we also realized that actually we don't want to do that because we actually want Evernote employees to have the experience of installing Evernote on like their uncle's computer and explaining how to use it and seeing how confused they are and actually getting that kind of feedback. So we kind of pulled back on that. Lots of other benefits and perks like that, but the idea is to say, okay, for some of you, this is a mission. This is your life's quest, and the only motivation you need is to make sure that your work is directly relevant and you can see the results right away. You don't need to pay these people very much. You don't need to give them too many perks. But then for the rest of the company, and as you get bigger, it's the majority of the company, it's your job to make this the best job of their lives, and you can do it this way. And I have a new strategy, and I don't know how well it's going to work, but I'm hoping it's going to work pretty well, of how I'm going to influence and retain control of the organization as it grows. In fact, one of the main things that I worry about is we're about to move. So we're currently on one, we're currently in like one floor kind of abandoned warehouse that we're sort of squatting in, but everyone is sitting together. And in June, we're moving to this brand new 5-story building that we're just taking over. And that's kind of terrifying to me. I mean, I've never been across multiple floors. Like, how do we keep the culture the same? I mean, yes, firemen's poles and slides and all that, obviously. But more than that, how do we actually keep this culture alive? I don't know. That's something that we're really going to struggle with. One of the things that I'm really hoping will work is this idea that I'm going to identify, and I've asked my co-founders and my management staff to identify employees at every department, at every level of the organization, who are the crusaders, who are on the same mission. Right? And you know these people. Like, you know these people when they first walk in. You can tell. And so identify who are the people who are on the same mission, and in every position, not in the management team, but in every position, in engineering, in tech support, in marketing, everywhere. Identify the people who are the true believers, who can articulate the vision, who are doing this for the love of the product and the company. Identify them, and then keep them there. Don't promote them or anything. Keep them there, and have them be your spies to make sure that the company is running well. So that's what we're going to try to do, a top secret plan. Hopefully no employees hear about this, but that's my goal. The coolest thing about this building, so I am kind of terrified about this, but there's one really cool feature, which is it's got a flagpole. It's got a giant flagpole right up front, which is super awesome because I've never had a flagpole before, and now we have a really big one. And so what we're going to do is we're going to get flags, giant flags, of all of the different products, all the different apps, the main Evernote app and Skitch and Food and Hello and everything else. We're going to get these. And whenever we have a big release, we're going to fly that flag. And then whenever there's too many bugs, we're going to fly it at half mast. And so people are going to know when they drive in, when they get to work, when they walk through the front door, they're going to know instantly what I'm pissed off about. Just sort of as an efficient form of management communication. So the next one is your investors. How do you keep your investors aligned for 100 years? How do you keep them in balance? And this one's pretty straightforward. It basically all comes down to just one thing, right? It comes down to an alignment of interests. You got to have investors who are in it for 100 years if you want to build a 100-year company. That's kind of rare. Most VC funds are about a 10-year lifespan, so how is a VC or another investor going to go into it for 100 years? Well, it's pretty straightforward. The main thing, and this is really an innovation, this is really something that's been happening in Silicon Valley just in the past couple of years, is there was this brilliant idea. It was really popularized by Facebook and by Yuri Milner and by a few other people, that you can decouple liquidity from exit. So in the past, most high-tech investors had this weird idea that, like, if you're a founder, you starve until you exit. So liquidity and exit were coupled. It's like you run your company, you get a small salary, and you could be worth, millions or billions of dollars in your options, but you don't actually get any money until you sold or you IPO'd. And that put this enormous weird pressure. It aligned all the incentives incorrectly. A few years ago, people figured out, hey, we don't have to do that. We can allow for multiple exits. So people can sell a little bit all the way through. So if you're an early employer and investor, you can sell some, 10%, 20% of your shares. You can put your kid through college. You can, you could buy a house. You can have, giant flags of your products made. And yet you still have enough to make it worthwhile. And the same is true for your early investors. So if you get an early fund that wants to invest in startups, by the time you're raising your third or your fourth round, they can sell a little bit, they can exit either a little bit or completely, and you can cycle into investors with longer term time horizons, and so you can keep doing this to basically make sure that you always have the right investor balance, that the people who are your investors at any given time are there for the long haul, and then you put off the IPO for as long as you can. So at some point, I think it is morally right to go public, especially for Evernote. I kind of believe that, you know, if we're going to make a 100-year company that's going to be everyone's external brain, I like the idea that everyone in the world will be able to be an owner. So I want to do it. I want to do the morally correct thing. But I don't want to do it too soon because it's, you know, a giant pain in the ass. So the idea is our plan is to get to be an IPO scale company pretty soon, probably by as early as next year. And then, you know, for the next few years through a series of investments, put off the IPO probably 2, 3, 4 years until it really makes sense to do it. So that once we do go public, nothing really changes, right? So the IPO is not an end. It's not an exit. It's not this event where afterwards everyone is hitting reload on the stock ticker. It's really just a milestone. It's really just another step. And you do that by having investors that have this alignment of interests. And so the last of the four things to balance out are your customers. This is the thing that can go out of balance pretty quickly. In fact, I would actually say that it isn't really your customers anymore. It's really your community, because those are the same things now. Your community, the people who talk about the product, really are the customers and vice versa, and those are connected. And actually, I think going forward and forever, that separation has just gone away. Like you're managing your community is managing your customers from now on. And the way that we think about this is we try to make sure that we have this very, very long-term business model that is aligned with the long-term interests of our community and of our customers. And it works like this. And here's where the heavy stats come in. They are coming. The basic idea is we want to have a business model that increases in value over time. So we want you using Evernote for 100 years, and we want it to feel more valuable to you every month that you use it. So the longer you use it, the more valuable it should feel to you. Because the more valuable something feels to you, the more likely you are to want to pay for it, and to pay for it, and to pay a lot for it, and so on. So this is the idea, right? The idea is increased value over time. And we do that in Evernote through the subject matter. Right, because Evernote is about your memories, because it's about your life, it naturally becomes more valuable to you over time. So if you use Evernote for 2 months, you put some memories in there, and then you don't touch it again for 2 years, you still have those 2 months of memories. They're still accumulating value. That's the whole goal of the business model, how to align our long-term interests with a user's long-term interests. And it works like this. So the entire Evernote business model can basically be summarized into 3 slides. So this is the 3-slide business model. So step one is the registration. So more and more people are registering. So this shows the user registration graph. It's a little bit out of date, but basically we have about 25 million users now. You can see the growth rate there. And this is all completely organic. We haven't paid for any users. This isn't, you know, we don't do any incentive downloads or SEO or SEM or advertising. It's just it's a direct download, word of mouth. And it isn't even viral. Right, because we don't really have viral features in Evernote until very recently. Really, Sketch and Evernote Food are our first products that are viral, that are about communication. Most of Evernote isn't about communication. It's really for you. It's not social. In fact, it's kind of antisocial. Right? We used to say, Evernote is antisocial. Evernote doesn't care about your friends. Evernote cares about you and about what's important to you and what's about in your mind. And so even though all of our user acquisition, 99.9%, comes from people just telling their friends to use Evernote, you don't do it because it benefits you. You just do it because you love it. So anyway, so slide one, more and more people are registering. Now, every successful consumer internet company or, you know, has a slide that looks like this. So I'm really glad that we have one too, but it's not super unique, right? You'll see slides like this in Uber and Instagram and pretty much anything else. You see this exponential growth of users. So very nice to have, hardly unique. Here's where it gets a little bit more interesting, and you have to think about this one a bit more. So this is our smile graph. I call it that because it makes me happy, because it looks like a smile, which is why I kind of focus on this among the thousands of graphs we have. Basically, I look at all the graphs we have, and I see which ones have interesting shapes, and those are the ones I present. So this one is really kind of unique and fundamental. In fact, I would say this is the 100-year startup. Like, this is the slide that is our strategy for the 100-year startup. So this shows the return rate by cohort age. What that means is what percentage of people are still active in Evernote X months after they first sign up. So in the first month that you see here, you see that 50% of people are still using Evernote in their second month. So 1 month after they sign up, 50% of people are not using Evernote. And then it decreases until it sort of flattens out here at about a year and a half. So after about a year and a half, about 22 or 23%, so it's about 23% of people who signed up a year and a half ago still used Evernote, you know, last month. And when we were first raising money, we only had about this much data. So we had data that went about, you know, about a year and a half. And we were really happy with that because most products, it continues to go down, right? It's actually quite rare for the return rate to kind of flatten out and stay in that, you know, 22, 23%, right? Most of the time, it drops off very quickly at first, then it slows down, but then it's still dropping off slowly. If you look at this kind of slide for like a typical game, like a Zynga game or something, what you see is they all kind of go to almost zero, which is why they have to keep making new games, they have to keep making new hits, because you don't get the long-term retention. Whereas for Evernote, once you've stuck with it for a few months, you pretty much never leave. But then it got even better. Then we saw that it's going back up. It's trending up. So what this shows is of our oldest cohorts, our oldest users, the ones that signed up 4 years ago, in fact, we just launched Evernote pretty much exactly 4 years ago into closed beta. Of the people who signed up to Evernote 4 years ago, 40% of them still used Evernote last month. So that's kind of fundamental, right? People that leave Evernote, they miss it, and they come back. A lot of people have this experience where they may have tried Evernote 2 years ago, you know, and they didn't care for it. You know, they didn't really stick with it. Maybe they used it for a bit, maybe they didn't, but they churned away. But then they keep hearing about it because of this community, right? Because our users are our community. They keep hearing about it. They keep being pestered by their friends to try it. And then 2 years later, they try it again, and they go, wow, it's a lot better than it was 2 years ago because the product is fundamentally improving. Because all we do, all the money we spend, we basically spend on product improvements. And so they hear about it again, they come back, and now they stick around. Or they use Evernote for a couple of months, they move away to something else, but they still have those few months of memories. Sooner or later, they want them, they come back, they see them, they get hooked in, and they start using it again. So this is that second slide. That the first one is more people are coming in. The second one is of those people, many more of them are coming back. And this is, I think, completely unique. I think the only other company that has a slide like this is maybe Facebook. But that's basically because everyone on the planet uses Facebook now, so if you sort of signed up for an account a few years ago, you're probably back into using it. And then the third slide, where it gets really unique, is this shows the actual revenue per month per user. So what you see is, this is average across all users, free and paid. Obviously, Evernote is a freemium model, so most people don't pay anything, but some people pay $5 a month. And what you can see is in the first month, we make about 3 cents per user, because only a small percentage of people pay. But then every month you keep using it, more and more people pay, so it just kind of goes up linearly. So our oldest users, the ones that have been around for about 4 years, we make over $1 per month average across all those users. So that's the three slides, right? Step one is you get more people to sign up without paying for it, without us paying to get people to sign up. More and more of those people keep coming back because we make a lifetime valuable product and feature focus only on product improvement. And more and more of those people pay because we never push them to pay. Because we never have a hard sell. There's no sales staff at Evernote. It's not our job to sell you anything. It's only our job to keep you coming back. Because, and this is the fundamental model, is it's more important that you stay than that you pay. This is our core business philosophy. It's more important that you stay than that you pay. The reason it's so important is because it rhymes. And we knew that when we found a rhyming business model and we matched it with a smiling graph, we were like, that's it. We can raise $1 billion on that. But it's more important that you stay than that you pay, because every month that you stay, you're actually more likely to pay the next month, and you're getting all your friends into it. But as soon as we put any pressure on you, as soon as you start to feel like we're putting on a hard sell, or maybe the free version isn't good enough, yes, you may be more likely to pay the next month, but you're also more likely to leave. And as soon as you leave, you lose all of your lifetime value. So here's how it works put together. Kind of works like this. So at the top here, you see the, and I told you there was some real data here. At the top, you see the return rates for our very first cohort, our very first month. This is March of 2008. So exactly 4 years ago, how many people started using Evernote? And it was about 31,000 people. About 31,000 people started using Evernote in March of 2008. In the very next month, about 65% of those people did not come back. They churned away. In the next month, another 5% left. But 2 months in, right, March, April, May, by May, that 31,000 people had gotten down to 11,000. And that 11,000 people never left. They stayed for the next 4 years, right? Once Evernote kind of gets under your skin, you never leave. But the graph below shows how much revenue we got from those people per month, not cumulative, per month. So in June of 2008, those 11,000 people, some of them converted to premium, we got $700 per month. But then over the next 4 years, even though some people stopped paying, since the whole point of this product is long-term compounding of value, we try to make it more and more valuable with time because it's your memories and the product gets better, as time goes on, a larger percentage of people pay, so that 4 years later, the same 11,000 people is now paying, you know, about $13,000 per month. That's how it works, right? That is the compounding value where that lets us align our long-term business model with the long-term interests of our users, which is how we hope to actually be able to build a 100-year company. When you look at this in total, when you sort of layer all these months up, you see this. I showed this graph last year, but it had a lot less data. But actually, the shape is completely held up. And what you can see here is this is every month on top of each other. So the tiny little blue, baby blue triangle at the top here, this is revenue that we get from people who signed up last month. But then every previous group, right, every previous month becomes more valuable. So the longer you stay, the more valuable you are. So our user base, it's like our users are a fine wine or like a stinky cheese or something. They get more valuable with age. And in fact, you can see some inflection points here. You can see three elbows where at these points, all the revenue started growing faster. And those correspond with new premium-only features. Right? Those don't correspond with like marketing campaigns. They correspond with product improvements. So every time we improve the premium product, that is the best marketing. More people start to convert. We get more revenue. We get more sales. And permanently, the compounding goes up. So to wrap up, the four things that we're trying to balance out, that we're hoping we can balance out for the company, you, your team, your investors, your customers. The good news is today, all of those things follow the same strategy. They're actually the same thing. They're actually completely interrelated. So what we try to do is we try to be completely transparent with all four of these. So the way we talk to our users is exactly the same as the way we talk to our employees. It's exactly the same as we talk to our investors. We try not to keep any secrets. We try not to have different messages. We try to say the exact same thing. And these different pools of people influence each other tremendously. So our best employees used to be part of our community. They used to be users. They still are. Our best investors as well. Many of the people who invested in Evernote are long-term users. In fact, the company was saved by a long-term user. Right? This is by now a kind of famous story, but we came within about 10 minutes of having to shut the company down in 2008. In October of 2008, when Lehman collapsed and there was a giant crisis, we had basically 2 weeks of cash left in the bank. We were going to close the company down. I tried to, you know, no one would return our phone calls in terms of investors. And I remember one night at 3 a.m., I was about to go to sleep thinking, okay, I'm going to go to sleep, go to the office the next day and lay everyone off. Just right before going to sleep, I got a random email from some guy in Sweden. And it said, hey, I'm a random guy from Sweden. They're very humble. The Swedish. I just wanted to write to you to say that I love Evernote. I've been using it for years, and I clearly love it. It's changed my life, so you've made me really happy. And I thought, great, made a random guy in Sweden happy. You know, that's something. And then he went on to say in his email, so I'm just writing to see if you need any money. And I wrote back to him at 3 a.m., why, yes, we do need money. I stayed up. And 20 minutes later, we were on a Skype call. And 2 weeks later, he sent us $500,000. He sent us a $500,000 investment. Which is what saved the company, right? That's what gave us enough money to stick with it, to get through the worst crisis, to actually land real investors. And then after that, it's been much easier. It's been all great. So it was a user, right? It was someone in the community who loved the product so much that all it took was him really loving the product and having many millions of dollars that he didn't mind losing. company solved. So it's the same strategy of transparency that we employ. And I think that today is the first time in the history of the universe where you can actually do this because there's five new things. I'll go through them really quickly, but basically between my first two companies and now, five things have changed. Five things in the past 5 years that are totally different. The first is app stores. This didn't exist before. So we used to have to worry about when we would do a new version of our software, we used to have to think about, well,
boy, how are people in Iowa going to get it? You know, we better have some kind of a relationship with a retail channel in Iowa. Now, you know, you have an app. Like, what do you mean, how are people going to get it? You put it in the App Store. The next day, everyone in the world can have it, right? So you don't have to worry about the logistics anymore. We have cloud services. Things that used to take you months and months and millions of dollars, you can set up yourself almost for free. You've got open source infrastructure. We used to have to spend millions of dollars on databases, on servers, on app servers. Now all of the best stuff is open source, all of the best quality stuff. You can launch something now at a 1/1000th of the cost of what it would cost you even 10 years ago. You've got social media. It is impossible right now to have a great product that everyone doesn't know about. It's physically impossible. If you come to me and you say, hey, I've got a really cool product, but no one knows about it. What's going on? The only thing that's going on is your product sucks. If you make a great consumer-oriented product, it is not physically possible that the entire world won't know about it, as long as you've done the bare minimum amount of work of, you know, putting it in the App Store and maybe tweeting about it once. Freemium economics lets you actually have a business model that scales really well. This wasn't possible before. And these five things, when you add them up, they add up to geek meritocracy. That's where we're living in now. These new things allow us to be in this wonderful state of the universe, which is a geek meritocracy, where all you have to do is do something you love. Another billion people will love it as well. They'll all know about it. They'll all get it. And they'll all be able to pay you, or at least come up with an economic model that lets you sustain yourself. And this is the geek meritocracy. And this was not even possible 5 years ago, but it's possible now. So now is the best time in the history of the universe to start a meaningful and enduring. So now is the best time in the history of the universe to start a meaningful and enduring technology company, which is, I think, the 100-year startup.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Great. Oh, and. We're hiring, so please. Any questions? Please.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
First one is, I think the long-term engagement numbers you show and the accumulation of users is very impressive. I'm curious about the second graph you showed, the smile graph.
Uh-huh.
In particular, I mean, the cohort at the very end, which shows an uptick. Monthly return rate?
Yep.
To what extent is that a selection bias? And do you expect users who start today to show a similar return rate trend?
To what extent is this selection bias? This last data point is a little bit of selection bias, and you can kind of see it's discontinuous over there. That bias is actually not because it's early, because there's 31,000 people in that cohort, so that's not Evernote employees. Like, we only had 15 people at that point. But what that is that's the month before app stores came out. So those people kind of got us downloaded us the hard way. So this last thing is anomalous, but from here on in, it's statistically significant and legit. And yeah, people signing up right now follow this behavior. Although, you know, you don't have this little smirk at the end, so you still have the smile, but not quite the smirk.
So just one follow-up question then. So is there something magical about, you know, month 38 to 40?
No. You really, in order to read the particular months here, you basically, this is the average across all cohorts. So we do this analysis, obviously, by cohort, where we pull all this out, and you can look at it, you know, month by month. And the months start differently. So, you know, one is like corresponds to the launch of the iPad, and the other one could be the launch of the Mac App Store, a big promotion. So the individual cohorts have some variations, which you can tease out by pulling them apart. But this is the average.
Okay. And the second question is, you know, you have this great amount of data, and you know, like problems that we're dealing with the overall internet. Eventually, you have this massive accumulation of personal data that becomes very difficult to sift through. I'm curious what your hopes are for the Evernote API, and what sort of things you expect to be developed on top of it to help make all that data meaningful for users.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we really want to own the idea of the intelligent cloud. So Evernote is meant to be a complete, everything you put into Evernote is bounded by your personal data, so it's all secured by your information. It's not shared unless you explicitly share it. It's all yours, and we don't go through it, we don't analyze it, we don't sell it to advertisers, we don't use it for data mining. Our business model is not to monetize your data.
right? Our business model is to give. Our business model is to make a service that a billion people fall in love with. 5% will love so much that they throw us $5 a month once in a while. Like, that's it. I only had half a semester of undergraduate business school. That's the extent of the business model. But within that parameter, we very much want everything you put into Evernote to be automatically related to everything else. So absolutely. So things you put into Evernote will get indexed and recognized and tied together. And we're just seeing the starts of that. So if you look at like Evernote Hello and Evernote Food, you see related notes sections. So if you go to a restaurant and you eat some meals, when you look at it later, you see like reviews of that restaurant that you took and other people that were there, and you see this related context. But that's the tip of the iceberg. That kind of intelligence for your own personal account is going to be huge in the next few months at Evernote. Please.
Hi.
Okay.
First of all, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
My name is Joy, and I actually, you know, that was a great ride, the presentation. It was just an awesome presentation.
Thank you.
And I think what would finish the story for me is to see a little bit of the work, sort of like what you said at the end where, you know, it was very late in the next day that you were going to possibly go off and lay off everybody. I think to complete the story, I need to see some more of that work that goes into all of these great things that happen.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. What kind of work do you think would be most useful to show, kind of in a show your work kind of way?
I'd like to see
the laugh that I was practicing when I was going to lay off everyone. I was kind of going for like a like that, or I wasn't sure.
I'd like to see a couple of struggles, or maybe some hard decisions that you went through on the way to coming up with something like housekeeping for everybody.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, that's very good, and I think it's probably useful to do one of these where we basically talk about all of the mistakes we made and how we corrected them, because there have been a lot of mistakes. We made a lot of product design mistakes, we made hiring mistakes, we made funding mistakes, we made a lot of mistakes, and yeah, that could probably be a much more interesting presentation than the one I just gave. So,
is there one that you could tell us right now?
Mistakes that we made? Yeah, I think, you know, I think from a design standpoint, I don't think we realized fully how important, at least on mobile, the utter simplicity of the design had to be. I think our biggest mistake within the design was we made the core product too complicated. And what we didn't realize is that it's easier to make something hard, much easier than to make something simple. We didn't fully grok that until much more recently. So now we're paying the price. We have to go back and make things simple, which is now even twice as hard because we didn't do it from the beginning. So that's probably the biggest mistake we made.
Thank you.
Thanks. I got to go in 2 minutes, so maybe two more questions.
Hi. In this world of sharing and publicity and stuff, Evernote made the brave decision to be about privacy, right from the get-go.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if, you know, to me that's brilliant. To me that's like one of the reasons it sticks out among so many of the other things out there. Could you speak a little bit about that and like how that kind of evolved?
Yeah, that's just purely based on that's what I wanted, right? This is what we wanted for ourselves. Like, you know, I'm not an avid user. Like, I'm just kind of antisocial myself. You know, I use Twitter and Facebook, but that's a small percent of my life. Much more of it is a little bit more introverted, and it wasn't anything out there. So we and my co-founders felt the same way. So that was very much like we wanted something to exist that was fundamentally private and secure, and nothing did. And so we made it just because that's what we wanted to do. We didn't go through an analysis to decide how big of an opportunity was it. It's just what we wanted to do.
Wasn't it also a software product first, right? That's more inherently like a private thing. And I'm very excited by that origin of Evernote.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, right? We didn't make a website. We started with native software and then made sure it was all connected after that.
Cool. Great job.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for a great speech.
Thank you.
My name is Miley, and I'm sitting back, and I'm a Swedish entrepreneur. So saying that Swedish is, we're humble. Thank you.
The main lesson I learned, the main lesson from all of this that I would take away, that you know I will carry to my grave and repeat over and over and over again, the secret to having a startup succeed is always answer emails from Swedes. I think this is this is fundamentally important.
We've developed one of the first touchscreen watches.
Wow.
And next to like Nike's with like billion, they have skyscrapers, I don't know, with our tiny little marketing budget, we're always like, yeah, by the way, we've done a watch that took us 4 years. I can totally recognize a lot of things that you said. And I just want to know, what was the name of the Swedish investor just called you?
I have asked him many times if he wants to be public, and he has said that he does not. He wants to remain anonymous.
See.
And I thought that it was, I'm sure, that it's because, you know, he's just generally noble and doesn't want you know, doesn't want to be famous for this. That's my theory. I think it probably has nothing to do with the Swedish tax authority. It probably has to do more with him being a noble.
Okay,
son.
Thank you.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you very much. Sorry to cut it short. Thank you.